Moralia, de stoicorum repugnantes. First, I hold that the agreement of a philosophy's doctrines ought to be examined in the lives of its adherents. For it is not merely, as Aeschines said of the orator, that word and law must speak the same thing, rather the philosopher's life ought to be in harmony with his teaching. For the philosopher's reasoned account is a law he has chosen for himself and made his own, at least if they truly regard philosophy, as indeed it is, not as play and word-hunting for the sake of reputation, but as a task worthy of the greatest seriousness. Since then, Zeno himself wrote much, considering how little he wrote on other things, and Cleans much, and Chrysippus most of all, on statecraft, on being ruled and ruling, on judging cases, and on public speaking. Yet in their lives one can find in none of them any generalship, any logiving, any entry into the council, any advocacy before the courts, any military campaign on behalf of their country, any embassy, any public benefaction. No, as though they had tasted some foreign lotus of leisure, they spent their whole life, no short one, but exceedingly long, in discourses and books and walks in the colonnades. It is not unclear that they lived their lives in agreement not with what they themselves professed, but rather with what others wrote and said, that very quietism which Epicurus and Hieronymus praise, living out their days entirely in it. Chrysippus himself, at any rate, in the fourth book on Lives, holds that the scholastic life differs not at all from the life of pleasure. I will quote his very words. As for those who suppose that the scholastic life belongs above all to philosophers from the outset, these seem to me to be mistaken, supposing that one must do this for the sake of some pastime or something else of that kind, and so drag out one's whole life in this fashion, which, if clearly examined, amounts to living pleasantly. For their underlying assumption must not go unnoticed, since many say this plainly and not a few more obscurely. Who, then, grew old more thoroughly in this very scholastic life than Chrysippus, and Cleanthes, and Diogenes, and Zeno, and Antipater, men who even abandoned their own native countries, with no complaint, except so as to spend their days quietly at leisure and engaged in literary pursuits in the Odeum and at Zoster. Aristocrian, at any rate, the pupil and kinsman of Chrysippus, when he set up a bronze statue of him, inscribed this epigram upon it. This new Chrysippus did Aristocrian dedicate, the cleaver that severs the knotty tangles of the academics. This, then, is the very Chrysippus, the old man, the philosopher, the one who praises the royal and political life, but supposes the scholastic life to differ not at all from the life of pleasure. As for the rest who do engage in public affairs, they are still more at odds with their own doctrines. For they hold office and judge cases, and give counsel and legislate and punish and honor, as though there really existed cities in which they hold office, with counselors and jurors always chosen by lot, and generals elected by show of hands, and laws those of Cleisthenes and Lycurgus and Solon, whom they say were foolish and senseless men, so that even in taking part in public life they contradict themselves. Moreover, Antipater, in his work on the dispute between Cleanthes and Chrysippus, records that Zeno and Cleanthes were unwilling to become Athenian citizens, lest they seem to wrong their own native countries. Whether these two acted rightly, and Chrysippus wrongly in having himself enrolled as a citizen, let that be set aside. But there is a great and absurd contradiction in keeping their names attached to their native countries while having so thoroughly estranged their persons and their lives from them. Just as if a man who had abandoned his wedded wife and was living and sleeping with another and begetting children by her should refuse to draw up a marriage contract with the second so as not to seem to wrong the first. Chrysippus, again, writing in his work on rhetoric that the wise man will engage in public speaking and in politics on the assumption that wealth is a good and reputation and health, thereby admits that their arguments have no practical outlet and are unfit for political life, and that their doctrines are ill-fitted to actual needs and actions. Further, it is a doctrine of Zeno's that one ought not to build temples of the gods, for a temple is not worth much and is not holy, and nothing made by the work of builders and craftsmen is worth much. Yet those who praise these sayings as sound are initiated in sanctuaries, go up to the Acropolis, bow down before the cult images, and hang garlands upon the temples, which are the works of builders and vulgar craftsmen. Then they think to refute the Epicureans for sacrificing to the gods, while they themselves are refuted still more, sacrificing as they do upon altars and in temples which they themselves maintain ought neither to exist nor to be built. Zeno posits several distinct virtues, differing from one another, just as Plato does prudence, courage, temperance, justice, as inseparable from one another, yet distinct and different. But then again, when defining each of them, he says that courage is prudence in matters to be endured, temperance is prudence in matters to be chosen, and justice is prudence in matters to be distributed, as though it were one single virtue that only appears to differ according to its relations to particular activities. Nor is it only Zeno who is found contradicting himself on this point. Chrysippus, too, while finding fault with Ariston for saying that the other virtues were merely dispositions of the one virtue, nevertheless supports Zeno in defining each of the virtues in just this way. Cleanthes, in his Physical Notes, having said that tension is a stroke of fire, and that when it becomes sufficient in the soul to accomplish what is required, it is called strength and power, adds in these very words, "And this strength and power, when it occurs with respect to things that must be firmly held to as they appear, is self-control. When it occurs with respect to things that must be endured, it is courage. With respect to what is deserved, justice, and with respect to choices and avoidances, temperance." Against the man who said, "Do not judge a case before you have heard both sides," Zeno used to argue in reply, employing some such reasoning as this: "If the first speaker has proven his case, the second need not be heard, for the matter under inquiry is settled, and if he has not proven it, it is just as if he had failed to answer when called, or answered but talked nonsense. But either he has proven it or he has not proven it, therefore the second speaker need not be heard." Yet having posed this very argument himself, he went on to write against Plato's Republic and to solve sophisms, and he urged his students to take up the study of dialectic as being capable of accomplishing just this. And yet either Plato proved, or did not prove, the doctrines in the Republic. On neither alternative was it necessary to write against him, but it was in every way superfluous and pointless. The same may be said concerning sophisms. Chrysippus holds that young men ought first to attend lectures on logic, second on ethics, and after these on physics, and likewise, last of all after these, to take up the account concerning the gods. He says this in many places, but it will suffice to quote what he says in the fourth book on Lives, in these very words. "In the first place, then, it seems to me, in accordance with what has rightly been said by the ancients, that there are three kinds of the philosopher's theorems, the logical, the ethical, and the physical, and that among these, the logical must be ranked first, the ethical second, and the physical third. And of the physical, last of all comes the account concerning the gods, wherefore also they have called the handing down of this account initiations. But this very account, which he says must be ranked last, the account concerning the gods, he habitually places first and sets forth in advance of every ethical inquiry. For he appears not to speak at all about ends, or about justice, or about goods and evils, or about marriage and the rearing of children, or about law and the constitution, except as those who bring decrees before the cities first write at the head, good fortune. So he too first writes at the head Zeus, fate, providence, the notion that the universe, being one and finite, is held together by a single power. None of these can be accepted as true unless one has been thoroughly steeped in the physical doctrines." Hear what he says about these matters in the third book on the gods. "For it is not possible to find any other origin or source of justice than that which comes from Zeus and from the common nature. For from this source, everything of this kind must take its origin, if we are going to say anything at all about goods and evils." Again, in the Physical Theses, "For it is not possible to approach the account of goods and evils, nor the virtues, nor happiness, in any other or more appropriate way than from the common nature and from the governance of the universe." And proceeding further, he again says, "For it is necessary to connect the account of goods and evils with these matters, there being no other, better source or point of reference for them, nor any other reason for which the study of nature must be undertaken than for the sake of the distinction between goods and evils." It follows, then, according to Chrysippus, that the account of nature is at once both prior to and posterior to ethics, or rather, the reversal of order is altogether impossible to sustain, if that which comes after is to be ranked after matters none of which can be grasped apart from it. And the contradiction is plain. On the one hand, he posits the physical account as the foundation of the account of goods and evils, while on the other he bids that it be handed down not first, but last of all those subjects. But if someone should say that Chrysippus has written, in his work on the use of reason, that one who first takes up logic need not abstain altogether from the rest, but must take a share of those other subjects too, as far as is given, he will speak the truth, but will only confirm the charge. For Chrysippus contradicts himself, at one point bidding that the account concerning the gods be taken up last of all, on the ground that it is for this reason even called an initiation. And at another point, saying that a share of this too must be taken up along with the first subjects. For the order is simply destroyed if one must take a share of everything in everything. But the greater point is this. Having made the account concerning the gods the foundation of the account of goods and evils, he does not bid that those who begin the study of ethics start from this, but rather that they take a share of it, as far as is given, while engaged with the other, and only afterward move on to this from those other subjects. Apart from which, he says, there is no possible starting point or approach to it at all. As for arguing on the opposite side of a question, he says he does not disapprove of it in general, but advises that it be used with caution, as in the law courts, not with the aim of advocacy, but so as to dissolve its persuasiveness. For those, he says, who suspend judgment about everything, it is fitting to do this, and it serves their purpose. But for those who are producing in their pupils the kind of knowledge by which we are to live in consistency with ourselves, it is necessary to instill and drill in the opposite doctrines, from beginning to end, in those who are being introduced to philosophy. And on these occasions, there is also opportunity to recall the opposing arguments, dissolving their persuasiveness, just as is done in the law courts. These are his very words. Now that it is absurd for him to suppose that philosophers ought to state the opposing argument not for the sake of advocacy, but, like pleaders at law, doing harm to it, as though contending not for the truth but for victory, this has been said against him elsewhere. But that he himself, not in a few places but in many, has constructed the arguments opposed to what he approves with such vigor, and with such seriousness and ambition, that it is not easy for everyone to discern which side he really favors, this the Stoics themselves say, in admiration of the man's cleverness. And they suppose that Carneades said nothing of his own, but merely took his starting points from what Chrysippus had undertaken to argue on the opposite side, and attacked his arguments from there, often murmuring, "Unhappy man, your own strength will destroy you," as though Chrysippus were giving great advantages against himself to those who wished to unsettle and slander his doctrines. As for what he published against custom, they are so proud and boastful about it that they say the arguments of all the academics put together, heaped into one, are not worthy to be compared with what Chrysippus wrote to discredit the senses. This is indeed a sign either of their inexperience or of their self-love in saying so. But this much is true. When he wished, in turn, to speak on behalf of custom and the senses, he became weaker than himself, and his second treatise was feebler than the first, so that he is at odds with himself, on the one hand always bidding that the opposing arguments be set forth not by way of advocacy, but with an indication that they are false, and on the other hand being, with regard to his own doctrines, a more formidable prosecutor than advocate, urging others to be on their guard against arguments on the opposite side, as distracting one's grasp of the truth, while he himself composes, with more ambition than the arguments that confirm our grasp, the very arguments that destroy it. And yet that he himself fears this very thing, he shows plainly in the fourth book on Lives, writing as follows. Nor should the opposing arguments be admitted just as they happen to come, nor should the opposing plausibilities be accepted, but one must be on guard lest, being distracted by them, men let go their grasp of the truth, being unable either to hear the solutions adequately, or, having grasped them, to shake them off easily. Since even those who hold fast to custom, and to the objects of sense perception, and other things derived from the senses, readily let these go when they are distracted by the questions of the Megarics, and by many other more powerful questions besides. I would gladly, then, ask the Stoics whether they think the questions of the Megarics are more powerful than those which Chrysippus wrote against custom in 6 books, or whether this must be asked of Chrysippus himself. For consider what he has written about the Megaric argument in his work on the use of reason. Something of the same kind has happened also in the case of the argument of Stilpo and Menedemus. For though these men had become greatly renowned for their wisdom, their argument has now turned to their reproach, on the ground that the one kind of arguer is somewhat coarse, and the other openly indulges in sophistry. Then, my good sir, these very arguments, at which you scoff, and which you call reproaches to those who pose them, as having their badness plain to see, you nevertheless fear that they may distract some from their grasp of the truth. While you yourself, writing so many books against custom, to which, whatever you discovered, you kept adding, in your ambition to surpass Arcesilaus, did you expect to disturb none of your readers. For he does not employ his arguments against custom in a bare, unadorned way. But, as in a lawsuit, sharing in some passion, he repeatedly says that it talks nonsense and babbles emptily, so that he might leave no possibility of denying that he argues on both sides. In the physical theses he has written as follows: it will also be possible, even while grasping something firmly, to argue the opposite side, providing the support inherent in it, and sometimes, grasping neither side firmly, to state what can be said on each side. And in his work on the use of reason, having said that one ought not to use the power of reason for purposes to which it is not suited, just as one ought not to use weapons for such purposes, he adds this: for the discovery of truths one must use it, and for their kinship, but not for the opposite, though many do this to many people. Meaning, presumably, the suspenders of judgment. But they, at least, apprehending neither side, argue on each side alike. As though, if anything were apprehensible, truth would provide its own apprehension only, or best, in that way. But you, who accuse them of this, yourself write the opposite of what you apprehend about custom, and dissuade others from doing the same thing with advocacy, while confessedly using the power of reason for useless and harmful ends out of sheer ambition to play the young man. Correct action, they say, is a command of law, and error is a prohibition of law. Hence the law forbids the base many things but commands nothing, since they cannot act rightly. But who does not know that for one who cannot act rightly, it is impossible not to err? So they make the law contradict itself, commanding what people are unable to do and forbidding what they are unable to refrain from. For the man who cannot be temperate cannot help being intemperate, and the man who cannot be wise cannot help being foolish. Yet they themselves say that to forbid is one thing, and to command another, and to say is yet another. For the one who says, "Do not steal," says precisely that, "Do not steal," and thereby forbids stealing, and commands not stealing. So the law will forbid the base nothing, if indeed it commands nothing. And they say that the physician commands his pupil to cut and cauterize, by omission of the proper time and measure, and that the musician commands him to play the lyre and sing, by omission of the tuneful and harmonious. And that is why they punish those who do these things unskillfully and badly. For the command itself was right, but they did not carry it out rightly. So too, when the wise man commands his servant to say and do something, even if the servant does not do it at the right time nor in the way he ought, and is punished for it, it is clear that the wise man was commanding a right action, not something intermediate. And if the wise commit intermediate acts to the base, what prevents the commands of law from being of that sort too? Moreover, according to Chrysippus himself, impulse is a man's reason commanding him to act, as he has written in his treatise on law. Then aversion, too, is reason forbidding, and avoidance is reasoned avoidance. And caution, accordingly, is reason forbidding to the wise man, for caution is proper to the wise, not to the base. If then the wise man's reason is one thing and the law another, the wise possess in their caution a reason that conflicts with the law. But if law is nothing other than the wise man's reason, then a law forbidding has been found, one that forbids the wise from doing the things they are cautious about. Nothing, says Chrysippus, is useful to the base, nor does the base man have need or want of anything. But having said this in the first book of On Right Actions, he says again that usefulness and favor extend to intermediate things, none of which is useful, according to them. And further, he says that nothing is proper or fitting to the base man in these words. In the same way, nothing is foreign to the good man, and nothing is proper to the base man, since the one is good and the other bad. How then does he wear us out again, in practically every book of physics and ethics, by Zeus? Writing that, we become dear to ourselves the moment we are born and to our own parts and offspring. And in the first book on justice, even the beasts, he says, have become attached in due measure to their own offspring, except fish, whose young are nourished by themselves. But there is neither perception where nothing is perceptible, nor attachment where nothing is proper to one, for attachment seems to be a perception and apprehension of what is proper. And this doctrine follows from the most authoritative principles. And Chrysippus, even though he has written much against it, is clearly committed to the view that neither is one vice greater than another vice, nor one error than another error, nor one virtue than another virtue, nor one right action than another right action. This is the man who says, in the third book on nature, just as it befits Zeus to take pride in himself and in his life, and to think great thoughts, and, if one may put it so, to hold his neck high and let his hair grow long and speak in a lofty manner, living a life worthy of such lofty speech, so all good men have a right to these things equally, being outdone by Zeus in nothing. Yet he himself, again, in the third book on justice, says that those who posit pleasure as the end destroy justice, while those who say it is merely a good and not the end do not destroy it. And here are his very words. For perhaps, if pleasure is left as a good but not as the end, while what is fine is also choice-worthy for its own sake, we could preserve justice, leaving the fine and the just as a greater good than pleasure. But if only the fine is good, then the man who declares pleasure a good errs, but errs less than the man who also makes it the end. This second man destroys justice, that first man preserves it. And on Chrysippus's own reckoning, community and fellowship are then utterly gone and lost, whereas the other view leaves room for kindness and benevolence. Further, as for his saying in his work on Zeus that virtues grow and advance, I let that pass, lest I seem to be catching at mere words, though Chrysippus himself bites bitterly at Plato and the others on this very point of terminology. But when he bids us not to praise every act done in accordance with virtue, he thereby implies some difference among right actions. For he speaks thus in his work on Zeus. Since acts in accordance with the virtues exist, it is proper that the things that are brought forward, and among these two, for instance, to stretch out one's finger bravely, and to hold back with self-control from a dying old woman, and to hear without overhastiness that 3 and 4 do not make 7, reveals a certain frigidity in the man who undertakes to praise and extol people for such things. Similar remarks are made in the third book on the gods. For I think, he says, that praise too will be alienated by such occurrences arising from virtue, for instance, holding back from a dying old woman and steadfastly enduring the bite of a fly. What other accuser, then, does this man await for his own doctrines? For if the man who praises such things is frigid, then surely far more frigid is the man who counts each of these things a right action, and indeed a great one, the greatest one. For if it is equal to bear the bite of a fly bravely, and to hold back temperately from the old woman, I think it makes no difference whether the sage is praised for the one or for the other. Further, in the second book on friendship, teaching that friendships ought not to be dissolved over every fault, he uses these very words. For it is fitting that some faults be altogether passed over, others receive only slight attention, others a greater degree of it, and others still be judged worthy of complete dissolution. But something more telling than this. In the same passage he says that we shall associate more closely with some, less closely with others, so that some are friends to a greater, others to a lesser degree. And as this variation becomes considerable, some become worthy of this much friendship, others of that much, and some will be judged worthy of this much trust and the like, others of that much. What else has he done here but leave great differences among these things too? Moreover, in his work on the fine, in support of the demonstration that only the fine is good, he uses arguments of this kind. The good is choiceworthy, the choiceworthy is pleasing, the pleasing is praiseworthy, the praiseworthy is fine. And again, the good is a cause for joy, what is a cause for joy is solemn, what is solemn is fine. But these arguments conflict with the passage above. For if every good thing is praiseworthy, then holding back temperately from the old woman would be praiseworthy too. Or else not every good thing is either solemn or a cause for joy, and then his argument collapses. For how can it be that for others to praise such things is frigid, while for the sage himself to rejoice and take pride in such things is not ridiculous? So he is like this in many places, but in his controversies against others, he cares least of all about saying nothing contrary to and dissonant with himself. At any rate, in his work against Plato's Protrepticus, taking Plato to task for saying that, for one who has neither learned nor knows how to live, it is more profitable not to live, he says, word for word. For such an argument both conflicts with itself and is least of all protreptic, exhortatory. For in the first place, by showing that it is best for us not to live, and in a sense urging us to die, he has thereby urged us toward certain other things rather than toward philosophizing. For it is not possible to philosophize without being alive, nor, if one does not go on living for a long time, to become wise, however badly and carelessly one has lived. And going on, he says that even the base ought to remain alive. Then, word for word. For in the first place, virtue in itself is nothing as regards our living, and just so, vice is nothing as regards our needing to depart from life. And indeed, there is no need to unroll other books to display Chrysippus's contradiction with himself. Within these very same works, he is found now praising Antisthenes, dictum that one must acquire either sense or a noose, and Tietius's line, before he comes to the bounds of valor or of death. And yet what else do these mean, except that not living is more profitable than living, for the wicked and the senseless? And elsewhere, correcting Theognes, he says, he ought not to have said, one must in fleeing poverty, but rather, one must in fleeing vice hurl oneself into the deep yawning sea or from towering cliffs Caenus. What else, then, would he seem to be doing but writing in himself the same doctrines and matters that he erases when others write them? Finding fault with Plato for demonstrating that not living is more profitable than living badly and ignorantly, while advising Theognes to hurl himself off a cliff or drown himself in order to escape vice. In praising Antisthenes for driving those who lack sense to the noose, he was condemning himself, since he had said that vice is nothing as regards freeing us from life. And in his work against Plato himself on justice, right from the start he leaps into the argument about the gods and says, it was not right to deter Cephalus from injustice by fear of the gods. For such an argument is easily discredited, and, being led toward the opposite, exposed to many diversions and plausible counterarguments, the discourse on divine punishments is no different from the bogey women Acco and Alfido, by which women keep children from misbehaving. Yet having thus torn Plato's views to shreds, he elsewhere praises them again and often quotes these lines of Euripides. But it is true, even if one mocks the saying, that Zeus and the gods look upon mortal sufferings. And likewise, in the first book on justice, he has cited these lines of Hesiod. Upon them, the son of Cronus sent a great woe from heaven, famine together with plague, and the people wasted away. This, he says, is what the gods do, so that, when the wicked are punished, the rest, using these as examples, may be less inclined to attempt such a thing. Again, in the treatise on justice, having first suggested that those who posit pleasure as a good but not as the end can nonetheless preserve justice, he sets this down, word for word. For perhaps, if pleasure is left as a good but not as the end, while what is fine is also choiceworthy for its own sake, we could preserve justice, leaving the fine and the just as a greater good than pleasure. So much, in this passage, about pleasure. But in his arguments against Plato, accusing him of apparently leaving health as a good, he says, not only justice, but also greatness of soul and temperance, and all the other virtues are destroyed if we leave pleasure or health or anything else that is not fine as a good. Now what ought to be said on Plato's behalf has been written elsewhere, against him. But here the contradiction is plain to see, since in one place he says that if one posits pleasure as a good along with the fine, justice is preserved, while in another he charges that those who leave anything other than the fine as a good destroy all the virtues. And so that he might leave no defense open even for these inconsistencies, writing against Aristotle on justice, he says, he is not right in saying that, pleasure being the end, justice is destroyed, and together with justice each of the other virtues as well. for justice is indeed truly destroyed by them, but the other virtues are in no way prevented from existing, even if not choiceworthy for their own sakes, yet at least as being goods and virtues that will result. Then he names each of them by name. But it is better to take up his own words. For, he says, if pleasure appears as the end according to such reasoning, then it seems to me that nothing of the sort is included in it at all. And so one must say that none of the virtues is choiceworthy for its own sake, nor any of the vices to be avoided for its own sake, but that all these things must be referred to the underlying goal. Nothing, however, will prevent bravery and prudence and self-control and endurance, and virtues akin to these, from being among the goods according to them, while the opposite qualities are to be avoided. Who, then, has ever been bolder in argument than this man, who has charged two of the very best philosophers, the one, that he destroys every virtue by leaving only the fine as good, the other, that, pleasure being the end, he thinks not every virtue is preserved without justice? For it is a marvelous freedom, when discussing the very same matters, to charge Aristotle with positing certain things, and then again to destroy those same things himself, when accusing Plato. And further, in his demonstrations concerning justice, he says explicitly that every right action is also a lawful act and a just act, and what is done in accordance with self-control, or endurance, or prudence, or bravery, is a right action, and so it is also a just act. How, then, does he not also leave out justice, when he leaves out prudence and bravery and self-control, in the case of all those who act rightly in the aforementioned virtues and are thereby acting justly? Injustice, being a corruption and internal faction of the soul, does not, even in those who possess it, lose its power, but sets a wicked man at odds with himself and dashes him together and throws him into turmoil. Chrysippus, finding fault with this, says, "It is said absurdly that a man wrongs himself, for injustice is directed toward another, not toward oneself." Yet forgetting this, he again says in his proofs concerning justice that the wrongdoer is wronged by himself, and wrongs himself whenever he wrongs another, becoming for himself the cause of his own transgression and harming himself beyond his desert. In his work against Plato, he made these statements about injustice being said to be directed not toward oneself, but toward another. For unjust men are not so constituted individually, but rather from a plurality of such men who say the opposite. And injustice being taken in another way, as it would be among a number of people so disposed toward one another, whereas toward a single person, with no such relation extending, only insofar as one behaves so toward one's neighbors is it so. But in the proofs, he has posed arguments of this sort about the unjust man wronging even himself. The law forbids becoming an accessory to a transgression, and to do wrong is a transgression. Therefore, whoever becomes an accessory to himself in wrongdoing transgresses against himself, and whoever transgresses against a single person also wrongs that person. Therefore, whoever wrongs anyone whatsoever also wrongs himself. And again, error belongs to the class of harms, and everyone who errs, errs against himself. Therefore, everyone who errs harms himself undeservedly, and if this is so, he also wrongs himself. And further, in this way too, he who is harmed by another harms himself and harms himself undeservedly, but this was what it meant to be wronged. Therefore, he who is wronged, even by anyone whatsoever, wrongs himself. As for the account of goods and evils which he himself introduces and approves, he says it is most in accord with life and above all in contact with our innate preconceptions. This he stated in the third book of his Exhortations, but in the first book he says that this account draws a man away from all other things, as being nothing to us and contributing nothing to happiness. Observe, then, how consistent he is with himself. The very man who declares that living, health, freedom from pain, and the soundness of the sense organs, things we ask of the gods, are nothing to us, at the same time asserts that this position is most in accord with life and with our common preconceptions. But so that there might be no denying that he contradicts himself, in the third book on justice he has said this. Wherefore, on account of the excess both of the greatness and of the beauty, we seem to be speaking of fictions and not in accordance with man and human nature. Is there, then, any way one could more clearly confess to contradicting oneself than this man does, when about the very things which he says, on account of their excess, seem to be fictions and to be spoken beyond man and beyond human nature. He asserts that these are in accord with life and above all in contact with our innate preconceptions. He declares vice to be the essence of misfortune, writing and insisting in every book, physical and ethical, that to live according to vice is the same as to live in misfortune. Yet in the third book on nature, having first said that it is more profitable to live foolishly than not to live at all, even if one is never going to become wise, he adds, for such are the goods that belong to men, that in a sense the evils among the intermediate things take precedence. Now that, having said elsewhere that nothing is profitable for fools, he here says that living foolishly is profitable, I let pass. But of the things called intermediate among the Stoics, being neither evils nor goods, when he says that evils take precedence, he is saying nothing other than that evils take precedence over things that are not evils, and that being unfortunate is more profitable than not being unfortunate. And he holds that not being unfortunate is less profitable than being unfortunate, and if less profitable, then also more harmful. So that not being unfortunate turns out, on his view, to be more harmful than being unfortunate. Wishing, then, to smooth over this absurdity, he adds concerning the evils. But it is not these that take precedence, but reason, in accordance with which it is more fitting to live, even if we are to be foolish. Now, in the first place, he calls evils, vice, and the things that partake of vice, and nothing else. And vice is a rational thing, or rather a mistaken reason. So living with reason while being foolish is nothing other than living with vice. In the next place, living while being foolish is living in misfortune, since one is so. In what respect, then, does this take precedence over the intermediate things? For he will surely not say that being unfortunate takes precedence with a view to being fortunate. But they say, Chrysippus does not think that either remaining in life for the good or departing from it for the wicked ought to be measured by these things at all, but by the things that are intermediate and in accordance with nature. Wherefore it sometimes becomes fitting for the fortunate to remove themselves from life, and for the unfortunate, in turn, to remain in it. What then could be a greater contradiction of the principle of choice and avoidance than this? That it should be fitting for those who are supremely fortunate to withdraw from the goods present to them because of the absence of things indifferent. And yet none of the things indifferent is, on their view, either to be chosen or to be avoided. Only the good is to be chosen, and only the evil to be avoided, so they hold. So it follows, on their own account, that the calculations governing actions are made with reference neither to things to be chosen nor to things to be avoided, but that men aim at other things which they neither avoid nor choose, and live and die with reference to these. Chrysippus agrees that goods differ from evils in every respect, and this is necessary, if the one sort makes men wretched in the extreme the moment they are present, and the other sort makes them supremely fortunate. He says that goods and evils are perceptible by the senses, writing in the earlier book on the end as follows. For that goods and evils are perceptible, this too makes it possible to say. For not only the passions are perceptible, together with their forms, such as grief and fear and the like, but also theft and adultery and things of that sort can be perceived, and in general folly and cowardice and not a few other vices, and not only joy and acts of kindness and many other right actions, but also prudence and courage and the rest of the virtues. Setting aside the other absurdity in this, who would not agree that it conflicts with their doctrine of the sage who is wise without knowing it? For if the good is perceptible and differs greatly from evil, then that a man passing from wickedness to virtue should be unaware of this, and not perceive that virtue is present in him, but suppose that vice is still present in him. How is this not most absurd? For either no one who possesses all the virtues can fail to notice or disbelieve it, or else the difference between virtue and vice, and between happiness and misfortune, and between the noblest life and the most shameful, is small indeed and altogether hard to discern, if a man who has acquired these instead of those can remain unaware of himself. There is a single treatise, On Lives, in four books. In the fourth of these, he says that the sage is a man of leisure and of few affairs, and one who minds his own business. And this is his statement. For I think that the prudent man is a man of leisure and of few affairs and minds his own business, since minding one's own business and being a man of few affairs are both fine things. Much the same he has said in the treatise on things choiceworthy for their own sake, in these words, "For indeed the life of quietude appears in truth to have something free from danger and secure about it, though not all people are quite able to perceive this." That this does not clash with Epicurus, who does away with providence through his doctrine of the gods' freedom from all business, is clear. But Chrysippus himself, in the first book on lives, says that the sage willingly undertakes kingship, making money from it. And if he himself cannot be king, he will live with a king and go on campaign together with a king, as was the case with Identhesius the Scythian or Lucan the Pontic. And I will set beside this also this other statement of his, so that we may see whether, as from the lowest and highest strings some conquered arises, so too the life of a man who chooses leisure and having few affairs is in harmony with then riding alongside Scythians and doing the business of the tyrants of the Bosporus out of some sort of necessity. For that he will also go on campaign with rulers and live with them. Let us examine again once we have taken up these points, some not even suspecting this, because of similar reckonings, and we ourselves also setting these aside for similar reasons. And a little further on, and not only with those who have made some progress and have been raised in a certain kind of training and habits, such as with Lucan and Identhesius. Some blame Callisthenes for having sailed to join Alexander, hoping to restore Olynthus, as Aristotle hoped for Stagira, and they praise Ephorus and Xenocrates and Menedemus for declining Alexander's invitation. But Chrysippus, for the sake of profit, thrusts the sage headlong into Pantacapium and the desolation of the Scythians. For that he does this for the sake of business and profit he has already made plain, having proposed that there are three sources of income most fitting for the sage: that from kingship, that from friends, and third besides these, that from sophistry. And yet in many places he wears one out with praising the lines. For what do mortals need, save these two things alone, the fruit of Demeter and a draught of flowing water? But in the books on nature he says that the sage, were he to lose the greatest estate, would think he had lost but a single drachma. So, having exalted him in the one place and puffed him up, he then in the other casts him back down again into wayjourning and sophistry. For he says that the sage will ask for and take his fee, in one case immediately at the start, in the other after some time has passed for the pupil, which he says is the more considerate way, though it is safer to take it in advance, since the subject admits of wrongs being done. And he speaks thus: not all sensible men exact their fee in the same way, but variously as the occasion offers, not promising to make their pupils good, and that within a year, but rather that whatever pertains to themselves they will do, up to the agreed time. And again, proceeding further, he will also know the right occasion, whether he ought to take the fee at once, together with the enrollment, as most have done, or also allow them time, since this subject admits of wrongdoing more than most, though it might seem the more considerate course. And how could the sage be a despiser of money, who under written contract hands over virtue for silver, and even when it is not paid, exacts his little fee, as one who has done his part? Or is he superior to harm, only guarding against being wronged in the matter of his little fee? For no one is wronged who is not harmed. Hence, having declared elsewhere that the sage is not wronged, he here says that this subject admits of some wrongdoing. In the treatise on the Republic, he says that citizens will do nothing and make no preparation for the sake of pleasure, and he praises Euripides for producing these lines: "For what do mortals need, save these two things alone, the fruit of Demeter and a draught of flowing water?" Then, going on a little from this, he praises Diogenes for masturbating in public and saying to those present, "Would that I could likewise rub away my hunger by rubbing my belly." What sense, then, is there in praising, in the same breath, the man who casts out pleasure, and the man who does such things and engages in such shameful conduct for pleasure's sake? For having written, in the books on nature, that nature has produced many animals for the sake of beauty, taking delight and rejoicing in variety, and having added a most irrational argument, that the peacock came to be for the sake of its tail, on account of its beauty, he then, again, in the treatise on the Republic, rebukes with youthful vehemence those who keep peacocks and nightingales, as though legislating against the lawgiver of the universe and mocking nature, who delights in beauty in such creatures. To which the sage gives no place in his city. For how is it not absurd to blame those who raise creatures, whose begetting he praises as the work of providence? So then, in the fifth book on nature, having said that bedbugs usefully wake us up, and mice make us turn to arranging each thing carefully, and it is likely that nature loves beauty, delighting in variety. He has said this word for word. This would be most manifest above all in the tale of the peacock. For there it is evident that the animal came to be for the sake of its tail and not the reverse, and that the female, at any rate, followed the male as he came to be so. But in the treatise on the Republic, having said that we are close to painting even our privies, he says a little later that some people beautify their farmland with climbing vines and myrtles, and keep peacocks and doves and partridges, so that they may cluck for them, and nightingales. I should be glad to learn from him what he thinks about bees and honey, for was it not consistent, having said that bedbugs came to be usefully, to say that bees came to be uselessly? But if he grants these a place in his city, why does he bar the citizens from the things that give delight to hearing and sight? In general, just as it would be absurd for a man to blame his fellow diners for making use of desserts and wine and delicacies, while praising the host who invited them to this and provided these very things, so too is he absurd, who on the one hand praises Providence for having provided fish and birds and honey and wine, while on the other hand blaming those who do not forego these and are not content with the fruit of Demeter and draughts of flowing water, which are present and by nature suited to nourish us. He seems to take no account of the fact that he is contradicting himself. Moreover, in the treatise Exhortations, having said that intercourse with mothers or sisters or daughters, and eating certain food and going up to a temple after childbirth or a death, have been irrationally condemned, and that one must look to the beasts, he says, and draw evidence from what is done by them, that none of such things is out of place or contrary to nature. For the placing of the examples of other animals side by side with these matters serves the timely purpose of showing that neither their coupling, nor their giving birth, nor their dying within temples defiles the divine. And again in the fifth book on nature he says, Hesiod does well to forbid urinating into rivers and springs, and one must all the more abstain from urinating toward an altar or a statue of a god. For it is not reasonable, if dogs and donkeys do this, and little infant children, that no attention or reasoning, having such and such qualities. It is absurd, then, that in the one case it should be fitting to appeal to the observation of irrational animals, but here that one should reason it out instead, to provide release from the impression that our impulses are compelled by external causes. Some philosophers construct a cert, adventitious, motion within the ruling faculty, a motion that becomes most evident in cases involving indistinguishable alternatives. For when, of two things equally possible and alike in every respect, it is necessary to take one, with no cause inclining us to the one rather than the other because there is no difference between them, this adventitious power of the soul, taking an inclination from itself, cuts through the impasse. Arguing against these men, as though they were doing violence to nature by introducing the uncaused, Chrysippus in many places sets down this argument. Can the knucklebone, or the balance, or many other things that cannot at different times fall or incline differently, do so without some cause and difference, either wholly within themselves or arising from external circumstances? For the uncaused is altogether non-existent, and so is the spontaneous. But in these adventitious motions fabricated and spoken of by some, hidden causes underlie them and escape our notice, leading the impulse now to one side, now to the other. These, then, are among the best known of the things he has often said. But what he himself has said, in turn, contrary to these, though not so readily at hand, I shall set forth in his own words. In his treatise on judging, having supposed that two runners finish a dead heat together, he raises the difficulty of what it is proper for the judge to do. Is it permitted, he asks, for the judge to award the palm to whichever of the two he pleases? And if they happen to be closer acquaintances of his, is it permitted, as it were, to grant him something of his own in this case? Or rather, in a way, since the palm has become common property of both, is he to give it as if by some hidden lot, following the inclination as chance dictates. I mean the chance inclination of the sort that occurs when two similar drachmas being set before us, alike in every other respect, we incline toward one of them and take it. In the sixth book on appropriate acts, having said that, there are certain matters not worth much trouble or attention, he holds that in such cases one ought to let the matter go, and allotting the choice to the mind's chance inclination, leave the decision to it. For example, he says, if among men testing two drachmas up to a certain point, some should judge this one to be the good one and others that one, and it were necessary to take just one of them, then, giving up further inquiry, we shall take whichever we happen to, allotting between them by some hidden reckoning, even if we thereby take the worse of the two. In these passages, then, sortition and the mind's chance inclination introduce the taking of indifferent things without any cause whatsoever. In the third book on dialectic, having remarked that Plato took dialectic seriously, and so did Aristotle, and after them those down to Polemo and Strato, and above all Socrates, and having exclaimed that one might well be willing to share even in the errors of men so numerous and of such stature, he adds, word for word, for if they had spoken of these matters only in passing, one might perhaps have made light of the point. But since they spoke of it so carefully, on the ground that it is among the greatest and most necessary of the faculties, it is not plausible that men who are, on the whole, of the sort we take them to be, should go so far wrong in this. What then of you yourself, one might ask? Do you never cease contending with and refuting men so many and so great, on the ground that you think they go wrong in the most authoritative and weightiest matters? For surely they did not write earnestly about dialectic while writing about first principles, the end of life, the gods, and justice only in passing and in jest, the very matters in which you call their reasoning blind, self-contradictory, and guilty of countless other errors. Malicious delight at another's misfortune, he says in one place, does not exist, since none of the refined take pleasure in others' evils, and none of the base take pleasure at all. Yet in the second book on the good, having explained envy as pain at another's goods, felt somehow by those who wish to humble their neighbors so that they themselves may excel, he goes on to add the matter of malicious delight. Continuous with this, malicious delight at another's misfortune arises in those who wish their neighbors humbled for the same reasons. But when they are turned aside instead by other natural impulses, pity arises. Here, then, he plainly leaves malicious delight standing as real, alongside envy and pity, though elsewhere he says it does not exist, any more than hatred of wickedness or love of shameful gain does. Though he has said in many places that over a longer span of time men are no happier, but just as much so, and equally, as those who partake of happiness for a single indivisible instant. He has again said in many places that it would not be proper even to stretch out a finger for the sake of a momentary wisdom, as though it were a flash of lightning passing by. It will suffice to cite what he wrote on this subject in the sixth book of the Ethical Questions. Having first said that not every good falls equally into joy, nor every right action into solemn pride, he adds, for indeed, if one were to possess wisdom for only a single instant, or as one's last, it would not be proper even to extend a finger for the sake of a wisdom that would be present in that way. Even though, over a longer span of time, men are no happier, and eternal happiness is no more choiceworthy than momentary happiness. Now, if he held wisdom to be a good that produces happiness, as Epicurus does, one would only need to seize on the absurdity and paradox of the doctrine itself. But since, according to him, wisdom is not distinct from happiness, but is happiness itself, how does it not contradict itself to say that momentary happiness is equally choiceworthy as eternal happiness, and yet that momentary happiness is worth nothing? The virtues, he says, follow reciprocally upon one another, not only in that whoever has one has them all, but also in that whoever performs any single act in accordance with one virtue performs it in accordance with all. For he says that no man is perfect who does not possess all the virtues, and no act is perfect that is not performed in accordance with all the virtues. And yet in the sixth book of the Ethical Questions, Chrysippus says that the excellent man does not always act with courage, nor the base man always with cowardice, but rather that, as various impressions come upon them, one stands firm in his judgments while the other abandons them. It is plausible, he says, that the base man is not always intemperate either. If then, acting courageously is the same as exercising courage, and acting cowardly the same as exercising cowardice, they contradict themselves in saying, on the one hand, that whoever possesses the virtues and vices acts in accordance with all of them at once, and, on the other, that the excellent man does not always act courageously, nor the base man always cowardly. He defines rhetoric as an art concerned with order and the arrangement of well-composed speech. And further, in the first book, he has also written this. I think that in speeches, too, one must attend not only to a liberal and unaffected order, but also to the delivery proper to them, in keeping with the fitting modulations of the voice and the gestures of face and hands. Yet this same man, so ambitious about style here, says again in the same book, discussing the clash of vowels. Not only must these be avoided by those who hold to the better course, but also certain kinds of obscurity and omission, and, by Zeus, solecisms, over which not a few others would be ashamed. To concede, then, at one moment that speakers should arrange their speech with propriety down to the gestures of hand and mouth, and at another that one need not attend to omissions and obscurities, nor be ashamed of solecisms. This is the mark of a man saying whatever occurs to him. And in the Physical Theses, having urged concerning matters that require experience and empirical inquiry, that one keeps silent unless one has something better and clearer to say. So that, he says, we may not, like Plato, suppose that liquid nourishment is carried to the lung and dry nourishment to the stomach, nor fall into other blunders of the same kind. I think that to censure others and then fall oneself into the very faults one censures, without guarding against it, is the greatest of self-contradictions and the most shameful of blunders. And yet he himself says that the combinations formed from 10 propositions exceed 1,000,000 in number, without either investigating the matter carefully himself or inquiring into the truth from those experienced in it. And yet Plato has the most eminent physicians as his witnesses, Hippocrates, Philistion, Dioxippus the Hippocratic, and among the poets Euripides, Alcaeus, Eupolis, and Eratosthenes, all of whom say that drink passes through the lung. But Chrysippus is refuted by all the mathematicians, among them Hipparchus, who demonstrates that the error in his calculation was enormous, since he makes the affirmative combinations of compound propositions 103,049 and the negative combinations 31,952. Some of the older writers said that what happens to a man who has sour wine, unable to sell it either as vinegar or as wine, happens also to Zeno. For his preferred thing has, in his system, a status that is neither that of a good nor that of an indifferent. But Chrysippus has made the matter still harder to settle. For at one time he says, those who count wealth, health, freedom from pain, and bodily soundness as nothing, and do not hold fast to such things, are mad. Yet at another time, citing Hesiod's line work, purses, scion of the gods, he declares that it would be madness to counsel the opposite, do not work, purses, scion of the gods. And the wise man, he says in his work on lives, will consort even with kings for the sake of profit, and will play the sophist for money, taking payment in advance from some of his pupils and making agreements with others. And in the seventh book of the On Appropriate Acts, and he will even turn a somersault for a talent, if paid to do so. Yet in the first book on goods he in a way concedes, and grants to those who wish it, that the preferred things may be called goods and their opposites evils, in these words. It is possible, if one wishes, to call one of these good and the other bad in accordance with such variations, provided one keeps to the actual facts and does not wander off in some other direction, not going wrong as to their meaning, but in other respects following ordinary usage in naming them. Thus, having here drawn the preferred close to the good and all but merged the two, he says again elsewhere, none of these things is of any concern to us at all, but reason draws us away and turns us from all such things. For this, he has written in the first book of the Exhortations. And in the third book on nature, he says, some men are counted blessed for being kings and being rich, as though one were counted blessed for using golden chamber pots and golden fringes, whereas for the good man, to lose his property is like losing a drachma, and to fall ill is like stubbing one's toe. Hence, he has filled not only virtue, but also providence with these contradictions. For on the one hand, virtue will appear utterly petty and foolish if it busies itself over such trifles, bidding the wise man sail to the Bosporus and turn somersaults for their sake. And on the other hand, Zeus becomes ridiculous if he delights in being called Ketesios, possessor, Epicarpios, giver of increase, and Charidotes, giver of grace, seeing that he evidently grants golden chamberpots and golden fringes to the base, and things worth a mere drachma to the good, whenever they grow rich by the providence of Zeus. Still more ridiculous is Apollo, if he sits pronouncing oracles about golden fringes and chamberpots, and about release from stubbed toes. Moreover, by their own proof they make the contradiction still more manifest. For whatever, they say, can be used well or badly is neither good nor bad. But all fools use wealth, health, and bodily strength badly. Therefore none of these is a good. If then, God does not give virtue to men, but the noble is a matter of free choice, while he gives wealth and health apart from virtue, he gives them not to men who will use them well but badly, that is, harmfully, shamefully, and ruinously. And yet, if the gods are able to bestow virtue, they are not good if they fail to bestow it. And if they are unable to make men good, they are unable to benefit them at all, since nothing else is either good or beneficial. As for judging as superior those who have become good in some other way, by virtue or by power, that amounts to nothing, for the good judge even the gods by virtue and power, so that the gods benefit men no more than they are benefited by them. And indeed, Chrysippus declares neither himself nor any of his acquaintances or teachers to be a sage. What then do they think of everyone else, but exactly what they say, that all are mad, foolish, impious, lawless, that they have reached the utmost pitch of misfortune and every kind of wretchedness? Are our affairs, then, faring so wretchedly, really governed by the providence of the gods? At any rate, if the gods should change their minds and wish to harm us, to do us evil, to pervert us, and to grind us down further, they could not put us in a worse state than we are in now, since Chrysippus himself declares that our life leaves no room for any excess of vice or wretchedness beyond what it already has, so that, if life could find a voice, it would say the words of Heracles, "I am full of evils now, there is no place left to put another." What statements, then, could one find more at odds with each other than Chrysippus's statements about the gods and about men? Saying that the one class exercises providence in the best way possible, while the other fares in the worst way possible. Some of the Pythagoreans bring a charge against him for writing, in his work on justice, concerning roosters, that they have come into being usefully, for they wake us and pick out scorpions and rouse us for battle, instilling in us a certain zeal for courage. Nevertheless, we must eat these too, lest the number of chicks exceed our need of them. Yet he so ridicules those who bring charges on such grounds that, concerning Zeus, the Savior, the Begetter, and Father of Justice, Good Order, and Peace, he writes this in the third book on the gods. Just as cities, when they grow too populous, send off their excess numbers to colonies and enter into wars against certain peoples, so God provides the beginnings of destruction. And he brings forward Euripides and others as witnesses, who say that the Trojan War was brought about by the gods for the sake of draining off the excess of the human race. But let the other absurdities of these views pass, for our purpose is not to examine whatever is not well said, but only to consider the points on which they contradict themselves. Is my present business. But observe that while he always attaches to God beautiful and humane epithets, he also attaches savage and barbarous and Galatian deeds. For such destructions and utter annihilations of human beings as the Trojan War wrought, and again the Persian and Peloponnesian Wars, do not resemble colonizations, unless these men suppose that some cities are founded in Hades and under the earth. But what Chrysippus makes God do to Deiotarus, the Galatian, is comparable. As when, several children having been born to him, wishing to leave the kingdom and the house to one, he slaughtered all the rest, just as one cuts off and lops the shoots of a vine, so that the one left might become strong and great. And yet the vine dresser does this while the shoots are still small and weak, and we ourselves, while puppies are newborn and still blind, remove most of them, sparing the mother. But Zeus, not only permitting and looking on while they grow to maturity, but himself having begotten and reared them, then beats them to death, contriving pretexts for their destruction and ruin, when he ought rather not to have furnished the causes and origins of their birth at all. This, however, is the lesser point. The greater is this. No war arises among men without vice, but one man is driven to conflict by love of pleasure, another by greed, another by love of glory or love of power. If then, God brings about wars, he also brings about vices, by goading and perverting human beings. And yet he himself says, in his work on judging, and again in the second book on the gods, that it is not reasonable for the divine to be held partly responsible for shameful things. For just as law cannot be held partly responsible for lawbreaking, nor the gods for impiety, so likewise it is not reasonable that they be held partly responsible for anything shameful. What then is more shameful for human beings than their destruction at one another's hands? A destruction whose origins, Chrysippus says, God himself supplies. But someone will say, by Zeus, that he again approves Euripides saying, if gods do anything shameful, they are not gods. And you have said the easiest thing, to blame the gods, as though we were now doing anything other than setting his own statements and assumptions side by side with their opposites. Yet this very thing now being praised will have to be said to Chrysippus not once, nor twice, nor three times, but 10,000 times. You have said the easiest thing, to blame the gods.